Thanks for tuning into Journey. Everyone is welcome at the table. We are a community being shaped by Jesus, experiencing and practicing humility, curiosity, belonging, and generosity. We hope to be a people who embrace the way of Jesus by listening first, speaking second, loving freely, and giving generously.
Let's dive in. We're starting a new series of conversations on Genesis 1. This will take us to Christmas. And if you're wondering how in the world will we spend all of this time on one chapter, well, you'll see. It's the most ridiculous chapter in the history of the Bible. And as a result, there's so much heat and debate and conflict around this thing. And so I want to start today by just laying some groundwork. There will be moments when we're in this series of conversations where it will feel really, really academic. And for those of you who are into that, you'll love it. And for those of you who are not into that, you will go, why? You'll ask the question that we asked in seventh grade algebra. When are we ever going to use this? Totally fair question. And the answer is, if you get the beginning of the story wrong, you misunderstand the problem that Jesus is trying to solve. So we're going to go straight from here into communion, and the reason for that is that when we understand how the Bible story starts and identifies the issues, communion becomes something much more than just a representation of our ticket to heaven. It has a much fuller and deeper meaning. So if we're wandering along and you're thinking to yourself, this is super painful, I totally understand that. You have grace all the way. The goal of the whole conversation, though, is that we might become people who are more full of wonder and awe and curiosity. Because our world, according to some great social commentators, is a disenchanted world. What science has given us so much, but science has also robbed the world a bit of mystery and beauty. And Genesis, as we'll see, isn't always interested in the scientific questions that we're most interested in asking it. It's wrestling with a different set of issues that we'll explore more as we go. So if I need to just shout out, like, there's a guy named John Walton who's done so much work on this, a guy named Tim Mackey who's part of the Bible Project who's done great work on this. We have a book list out there of commentaries and books if you're interested in going deeper. You don't have to take my word for this stuff. You can go, the goal is that you would study it yourself and wrestle with some of these things. We consider it a success if somebody comes back a week later and is like, hey, I really thought about this thing you said all week and I disagree. Wonderful. Like, the fact that you actually thought about something that was said in this little hour of time we have together, like, that's huge. That's wonderful. All right, so what is Genesis 1? We'll get to this down the road, but at the very least, it is one of the most masterful artistic creations in ancient literature. I want to just throw up a slide that the Bible Project uses that kind of gives you just a bit of an overview of how this thing fits together. There is all sorts of parallelism that goes throughout this chapter. The chapter, our verse numbers really lead us astray in Genesis 1, because Genesis 1 doesn't end until four verses into Genesis 2. And that's when this story ends. And the story is bracketed, the 6 days of creation are bracketed by a prologue. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then a one-sentence summary, epilogue. Thus were finished the skies and the land and all their hosts. All right, so those two sentences bracket the 6 days, but then there are three sentences that explain the prologue, and we'll talk about those, verse 2, 3. And then there are three lines that explain the epilogue. And they're all around the number 7, which has massive resonance throughout the whole chapter. And I just want to highlight this at the very beginning to say that what we're dealing with isn't an ancient report where the teacher said, hey, how did God make the physical universe? What we're dealing with is something that has been literarily and artistically put together to make a really profound theological point. And this is just skimming the top of its artistry. So it is a section that's bracketed by these beautiful patterns that almost rhyme like poetry does. Now, let's start. We'll just kind of get into the first couple of words of chapter 1, verse 1, page 1. Ladies and gentlemen, what could be clearer? In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In English, it makes total and complete sense, doesn't it? What's there to debate about? Come on, ma'am. Let's consider the word heaven. As good evangelicals, all right, most of us, or maybe lapsed evangelicals for some of us, when you hear the word heaven, what comes to mind? Not the right answer, but what comes to mind in our imaginations when you hear the word heaven? Come on. Clouds, golden streets. What else? Harps, angels. What? Mansions, the galaxy. Ooh. The afterlife. Oh, that's so good. Yes. Yes. Eternal would be another word I would have, or like bliss, like some sort of ultimate happiness. And when do you get to experience heaven? Yes. It's after you die. So, as an evangelical, whenever I heard the word heaven, I thought exactly what you said. The good place you go when you die, but your soul goes there, and you sort of, it's a heavenly worship service, and it's almost in another dimension. It's not like if you go far enough into the galaxy, you find heaven. It's like a whole different realm. So it's this post-mortem, after death, other dimensional realm of like eternal disembodied bliss. That's how I would just automatically have assumed what the word heaven meant. And earth, if I were to ask you the same question, what comes to mind when you hear the word earth? This is what comes to my mind. Nick, go ahead and throw that up there. A floating blue globe in the middle of a bunch of black space, right? When I hear earth, I think planet. I think sphere. I think like it's sort of hanging there. And that's what I think of when I hear the word earth. Now, the question is, how long has that view of earth been available to human consciousness? Yeah, here's the first one, at least that was very public. It was in the 1960s. Taken from the moon, it's called Earthrise, literally the most reproduced image in the history of human beings. But yeah, that wasn't available to us until 1950s, 1960s. And people had argued, of course, and known that the earth was round and not flat. I mean, although, you know, there's disagreement. prior to seeing it, but would the ancient Hebrew author have had access to that image when he or she used the word earth? No. And would the ancient Hebrew author have thought of a post-mortem, disembodied, eternal realm of bliss in another dimension when they used the word heaven? No. And this is going to be really profound, because in the very first verse of the Bible, unconsciously, we have smuggled in 21st century understandings of words and concepts that would not have all been what the author had in mind. And we almost, like we did with Revelation, we almost have to unlearn all that we think we know into this in order to really hear what it's saying. So let's meet heaven and earth in the Hebrew text. Earth is the word eretz, and it literally means the land. This, right here, the stuff down here. And heaven, shemayin, is the word for sky. So, in the beginning, God created what's down here and what's up there. Far different from a floating sphere and disembodied bliss. Would you agree? And it makes sense, right? And in a society, an agricultural society before electricity, right, imagine what the sky looked like. And so, yeah, in the beginning, God made what's down here and what's up there. Cool. So already, our predetermined meanings of words are called into question. Are you with me? I know this is a really simple and silly example, but it actually works the whole way through Genesis 1. Because we'll hear words like, oh, beginning, or create, or day, and we're packing those suckers with what we mean. And this is what we do with the whole Bible, and sometimes we do that rightly, absolutely, but not every time. Now, when did God create what's up there and what's down here? When did he do it? In the beginning. What could be clearer? So, in the American imagination, the beginning is a singular point in time that begins a linear sequence of events, correct? The start of a race, birth, right? Whatever. A linear, singular point in time that begins a linear set of events. And the Hebrews had a word for that. That's not the word that's used in Genesis 1. The word that's used, Nick. He's getting me because I made fun of him last service. There's the word. It's pronounced resheet. Okay, say it. Resheet. Bunch of junior hires in here. I had to practice saying it all yesterday in the mirror. Resheet. So the Hebrews have a word that captures the American understanding of beginning. And that's tekela. And I don't, man, Hebrew, I'm a neophyte, so I can't even get the gutturals right, but it's kela or something. Reshit, which I can pronounce much better, stands for an unspecified period of time in the past that serves as an introduction to the material the author wants to cover. Hold on, I don't buy that. Oh yeah? Fire up Job. Resheet. Now notice how this word is used. It's translated beginning. Americans, beginning. Singular point in time, linear series of events. But notice how it's used here, right? The book of Job starts with Job being upright and being blessed mightily by God materially. And then there's this weird wager that takes place. And then Job's life takes a downturn, right? And then his friends are like, hey, bro, just so you know, it's your fault. Like, if you were actually a good guy, this would never have happened to you. And Job's like, well, I actually am a good guy. And it's horrible if you take, you know, time to read the 32 chapters. It's just like, wow. In chapter 8, we meet the word resheet. Job is being told, if you are pure and upright, surely then God will rouse himself for you and restore you to your previous place. Even though your beginning was insignificant, your end will be great. So the word resheet, even though your resheet was insignificant, does that mean his birth? Or does that mean his life before his suffering? Are you with me? It means the unspecified period of time before his suffering. That's called the beginning. And do we know how long it was? And do we know how long ago it was? It just says, prior to Job's suffering, he was insignificant. But the end of his life after his suffering will be great. Are you with me? Let's go to Jeremiah. Notice how resheet is used here. Jeremiah 27 and then 28. In the resheet, or the beginning of the reign of Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, the word came to Jeremiah from the Lord saying, and then there's this oracle. So in the resheet, the beginning of the reign of Zephaniah, and you're like, okay, cool. So the singular point in time when he took the throne. Nope. Because 28 says, now in the same year, in the resheet of the reign of Zedekiah, king of Judah, in the fourth year, in the fifth month. So how long was the resheet here? 4 years. So the 4 years is just called the beginning period, the preliminary period before we get to what it is the author wants to say. Are you with me? And if you're like, this has big implications. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, it does. Reshit, next slide, if you would, Nick, refers to an unspecified period of time in the past. Now, in the case, right, of what we just looked at in Jeremiah, it was specified. It was 4 years. But in the case of Job, it wasn't specified at all. It was just the beginning time. It doesn't refer to a first point in time, but a preliminary point. Not a point, but a preliminary era of time. So when it says, in the beginning, God created what's up there and what's down here, is it telling us when that happened? No. In fact, English colloquialisms that we could use for reshit would be things like once upon a time. If I started out a story saying once upon a time, what's the question you would not ask? Well, how long ago? When did it start? You would just know I'm using a colloquialism to get to the story I want to tell. Right? Or way back when. This is how one scholar translates reshit. Way back when. Well, when? The author doesn't tell us. Just way back when God was creating, he created the heavens and the earth. Or, Star Wars fans, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. What are the two questions you do not ask when you see that? Well, where and how long ago? So, I hope you're seeing the train coming. Because this, we're going to take 11, 12 weeks to make the following point. The first sentence of the Bible does not give us the information that fuels the debates around the first verse of the Bible. The author doesn't give us a timeline. The author just says, way back when, God created everything. Next sentence. Are you with me? Now, you don't have to buy this, but again, do your own research. So, heavens and earth, we think, okay, sphere, globe in the sky, or disembodied other dimension? No. Land, sky. Beginning, singular point in time? Nope. Unspecified period of time somewhere back there that gets us into the action and story I want to tell now. And this, brothers and sisters, is where we get into some really thick distinctions. Because what we want Genesis to answer, Nick, are when and how. When did the universe come into existence and how did it come into existence? But as we're going to painstakingly see over the next several weeks, the author of Genesis is interested in what was created, everything, and why it was created. This is the difference between physics and metaphysics, for you scholarly types. Physics, of course, we're seeking to understand the relationship between the physical structures of the universe and its dimensional settings and all of this beautiful stuff. Metaphysics is what I did my graduate work in, which is the questions of meaning and purpose and significance behind the physical structures. So it deals with worldview questions like, where are we? Well, we're on Earth, and that will have very important implications. Who are we? We're image bearers. Ooh, that has important implications. What's wrong? The image bearers are no longer imaging God into the world. And what's the solution? We're waiting for the perfect image of God to come and show us what it is to image God into the world and create space where that happens. This is what Genesis 1 sets up. And as much as we want it, because, I mean, there are two competing stories we are all told we have to choose between, right? So we've got this scientific story over here. Hey, the Earth is 14, 15 billion, not the Earth, the universe is 14, 15 billion years old. Earth is probably 5, 6 billion years old, whatever it is. And there was a series of slow, gradual processes that, you know, eventually resulted in consciousness and whatever else. And then there's the biblical story, according to some. No. If you add up the chronologies of Genesis, the earth is probably 4,000 to 6,000 years old, and it was created in 7 days. 6 days, and with a seventh, you know, he rested, but 6 24-hour periods of time that resulted in the universe that we have now. Yeah, but science, bro, come on, tells us it's old. Yeah, but Adam and Eve, right, they weren't born infants, so of course they looked older than they actually were. You're an idiot. But if you don't believe this, then you don't believe the authority of the Bible. Then so much for the authority of the Bible. That's the debate, correct? What do both positions assume? They both assume Genesis is telling how old the earth is. And what if it's not? And what if it never meant to? In fact, and this muddies the waters, but there is no definitive article in Hebrew. Literally, the first word reads, in beginning. There's no the. In beginning, God created. Now, let's get to the good stuff. That's how this reads. Okay, now, a couple other points to make, but let's pause it for questions. All right, if you have any. And some of the questions we'll explore in future weeks. Here we go. Beautiful. Oh, let there be light. Yeah, that is. Hi.
Hello. So you kind of exegeted in the beginning and heavens and earth. Is there any exegesis for created?
Oh, bro. Okay. This, when we get to this word, which could be next week or a couple weeks from now, it will be one of the more painful sermons in the history of the world. Because when we hear the word create, we hear brought into physical existence. When they use the word create, they mean given a name and a function in an ordered universe. So like on the first day when he creates light, does he create light? Because the sun isn't created till later. No, he's creating time because he's separating and naming. So yeah, we're going to get there. And it's going to have profound implications for what it is that this watery mess, tohu vavohu and the deep and all, oh, it's going to be glorious. But it's going to be really painful because we have to unlearn all this stuff. Right? Yes, I have to sell this. Yes, keep coming. Yes.
Are we supposed to assume that when he says day, are we supposed to assume a 24-hour period? Does yom mean 24-hour period?
Oh, see? We'll get there. And it can, and it can't. It's used both. But when we get to, I don't know, in 10 weeks from now, the point of Genesis 1, you'll see why that is an important question. Because it's not used chronologically, it's used in a different way. Again, we hear beginning and then a series of six, and we think, ah, point in time, linear sequence. And there is some linear sequencing here, but it's not, it's just so shocking what it turns out to be. And I think more beautiful. Yes, sir. Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have another one? Oh.
Over here.
Okay, Susie. Sorry, we'll get to you, sir.
Hey, quick question. Thank you so much. Way here in the back. I was wanting to ask, so typically when I hear creation stories, there's very much an ex nihilo or like out of nothing concept.
Yes.
One of the biggest appeals to it is to talk like out of every concept, it all comes from God. Like, we can't, even beyond our imagination, which can kind of be a mind bender, but
yeah.
It's kind of a huge concept. This probably is going to go later into the series, maybe too much to unpack right now, but are we, and then I was curious too, like, are we getting more into the concept that God's more naming things that are already in existence, or that
yeah.
which is already coming from that already is the I am that I am, or
yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, how do we work with concepts like that?
Oh, love
sorry,
it.
I know it's kind of a big question, but
that's
thank
a
you.
Wonderful question. This is what, but yes. So, sorry, it takes a lot to get my butt up there. It's just, it's like a squat, you know, with plates. So, I don't know how, here's the beautiful thing. I don't know how deeply we'll go into other ancient Near Eastern cosmological accounts, but they all have a theogony, which is a story of the birth of the gods. Yahweh does not have one. And in fact, heaven and earth in Genesis 1 function in Hebrew as something called a merism, which is like if I were to say something like, man, I bought everything in that store from A to Z. Does that mean I bought letters at the store? No, but I'm using the polar extremes to say I bought everything, right? So heaven and earth is being used like that here. So I think the Bible teaches that God created everything. But I don't know how clearly Genesis 1 teaches that, because we're going to meet a watery mass that's related to bara here in a little bit. So you guys are anticipating beautifully. And Tim told me, he's like, hey, give him a little bit. Don't just tell him it's going to be in the future. But it's going to be in the future. And that's that's a little bit. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Thank you for giving us a thumbnail.
A thumbnail, okay. All right, Tim, you were right. Tim, I submit to your wisdom. Perfect. Now listen, you don't have to buy any of this. The goal is that you would go and approach the text. Like, if you want homework, here's homework. Print out Genesis 1 through 3 without verse numbers or chapters numbers. Okay? Just get on Bible Gateway and delete. Put it on a Word doc. Delete all the verse numbers and chapter numbers. And then read it 3 or 4 times in English. And in one column, write, circle all the things that are repeated. Just circle it. Just notice. And then in a different column, write down all of the questions and problems there are. Why is there a talking snake? Right? That seems like a big issue. Why in Genesis 1, the animals come first and then the humans, but in Genesis 2, the humans come first and the animals? Oh, like, so just, if you want homework, do that. And then allow all of that to fuel curiosity. Because let's just assume for a second that there's a reason why it's like that. And we don't know what it is because we are blinded by our predetermined assumptions heading into the text. Does that make sense? So that's so good. Was the turning the light off to suggest we should move on? Okay, yeah, we ended so early last service and we don't want to do that again, right? I mean, we want to...
Oh, sure. Am I on?
Hi. Oh, you are on, sir.
Okay. I don't want to nerd out too much here.
Really? You're worried about that right here?
But in my brain, the nerd muscles are...
Let it go. Okay. Let it go, sir.
So just like all ancient words, there is a range of meaning.
Yes.
So how do you know that... Because one of the uses of reshit is point in time.
Yeah.
So why is it that Genesis 1:1 cannot mean... point in time.
Yes. Okay. Are you a reader? You sound like a reader.
I read the funny papers.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
So a guy named John Salehammer wrote a book called Genesis Unbound. And he actually argues that the whole creation story is about the creation of the promised land, not the universe. And that he argues, and it's so compelling, and I almost geeked out on it, but I was like, nope, that's too much. But he argues that when the Jews would hear the word land, they would not think land, they would think the promised land. And so that literally the Genesis 1 and 2 stories are of the creation of the promised land and then the Garden of Eden as the temple of God on earth, overlapping the heaven and earth space. We're not going to go in. We'll get into some of that when we get into Genesis 2, because there's temple imagery dripping all over the place. But he would argue, Reshit, there isn't a point where Reshit means point in time singular. It can serve as the introduction of an unspecified period of time, but it doesn't serve as a point in time to a linear sequence the way the other Hebrew word does. Right, that's his argument. And I've seen it channeled by enough Hebrew scholars that I trust that take on it. If we want to talk and geek out and nerd out later, I'm all in. I'm all in. The lack of the definite article, I don't know if it helps or not, but it certainly leaves beginning open, much more open than the English does, right? Because in the beginning, it sounds like a singular point in time, but then you're like, oh, there's no definite article there. And you're like, oh, in beginning, which in my view leads that direction, yes.
The way that it's read by Jewish people out of the Torah today, or are they misunderstanding it like we do, or
yeah.
Are they getting a good chuckle?
Yeah. Man, I can't speak for a lot of Jewish scholarship. I love reading modern Jewish scholars. And the ones I read, this is all I can speak to, the ones I read absolutely understand it in the way that we're going to explore it. Yes. Yeah.
I got one over here.
Okay, last one, and then we'll... Last two, perfect. Oh, hey.
Oh, sorry. You know, they're talking about the days.
Yeah.
Of creation. I was reading, I don't remember the exact Bible verse, but it says, to God, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years like a day.
Right.
So a day could be whatever God wants it to be, basically.
Right.
It could have been who knows how long that right. day was. Yeah.
Yes. But as we'll see, as the other gentleman mentioned, it's true, it can be used either way. But we're asking it to do something that it's not going to be designed to do, which is to tell us how long the days were. So day is going to function as differently than that once we get to Bara. So great comment. Yes, thank you.
So why do you think our translation got translated in the way that it did if it doesn't mean what we're believing that it means?
Because we wanted to avoid the problem that was brought up by this gentleman here, which is pantheism, that somehow the universe is eternal too. So, and I think the Bible is clear that God is separate from the universe and the creator of everything. I don't know that Genesis 1 is as clear about that as we think it is. So the was put in there in the medieval period when there were massive debates about how eternal is the universe. And so, absolutely. So this is an instance, and again, I'm no expert on this. I couldn't give you the translation history of the definite article. But I would want to know enough to say, hey, if you're interested, like poke around here. That it was brought in because it was congruent with later teaching. That the beginning meant that there was nothing that existed prior to God's activity. And bara, even when it means, as I'll argue, something is brought into existence when it's formed, it still means bringing something new into existence that didn't exist before. So, but again, I just want to, and this is so what happens, but you notice how the questions are, it's like this. No, this is so good, and this is, but I'm reflecting on the last two services of questions. It's like, have you ever been to the Grand Canyon? Like, have you ever physically been there? I was 16, so what, 10 years ago?
Yeah.
And it was before they had the glass walkway out, you know? Because, as kids, raised in the 80s, we didn't wear seatbelts and whatever, so we could totally slip through these bars and it was fine. But I remember the first time I ever saw it, and the, like, My brain wasn't big enough to capture what my eyes were seeing. Like, I just had to sit there. And even then, any memory or photograph I have just doesn't, it's not even close. But can you imagine if you were at the Grand Canyon and you heard two people getting into a passionate argument about how it was created? Was it a glacier? Was it a meteor? Or whatever the other geological options are for that. And they get into this passionate argument while they're standing in front of it. And you would look at them and you'd be like, hey guys, let's just soak this in. And even the questions, we want to not soak. We want to, how long are the day? I mean, and those are all legit, man, absolutely. And we'll get into all that stuff. But I almost want to, like, not start there and just go, can we, the vision of God that Genesis 1 gives us is so much better than these debates ever credit him as being. And what we've lost a bit is this sense of, like, awe and wonder when we come to a text like this. So I'm going to be working overtime and just trying to get us to be like, okay, this is amazing. And what this is saying, if we actually trust God is like this, then we don't have to set that God aside when we get to Jesus and say, whew, the Old Testament God is ugly. Because if this is the God that Jesus represents, and it is, then you're like, this is amazing. And it makes sense why Jesus comes, not because that God had to punish us and take it out on somebody, and Jesus was like, okay, don't hit them, hit me. It's something bigger than that. So that's why all of this work matters. And so as much as we can, we want to just trust the story that's given to us without having to rush ahead into all of the disputing. And I realize that's hard for some of us because we were told our view of Genesis 1 is so important that it either means we trust the Bible or we deny the Bible. And I just think that's really not true and harmful. And if you want to know where we're at, where I'm at, I take the Bible in the most serious possible way that I can. I'm willing to do all of the work to unlearn so that I can hear it on its own terms. And even then, I don't always. And so we have a massively high view of the scriptures, but I also have a massively high view of the ways in which we wear cultural blinders. So we're just a people standing in front of a God. I don't know the rest of that rom-com line. What is it? Asking God to love us. Oh, Lord. Okay. On that note, we're going to go to communion. And why are we taking communion? Because communion answers the Genesis 1 story. Genesis 1 sets up what Jesus' death means and what it accomplishes. So the table is open. There are, of course, pieces of paper around the room where you can write down prayers and prayer requests. But I think just the biggest thing is like, hey, do we trust God enough to just even ask some of the big questions and wrestle and say, God, am I missing the Grand Canyon for the sake of the discussion about it? You know, and so my prayer, Lord, for me and my brothers and sisters is that you would humble us to the point where we capture wonder and awe. And Lord, I love this community so much. We're wrestling with the text and its implications, and I love that. I know you love that. And I also just want for us to be people who, are curious enough when we encounter all of the strangeness in the text to believe that there's something far more beautiful than we initially see going on. So to that end, Lord, would you really journey with us and be speaking to us in the name of our Christ. Amen.